This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Richard Ewart. Coming up, the Pacific carver industry still waiting for a government pledge on easing import restrictions to be put into action in Australia. It's not just Canberra, Washington and New Delhi are stepping up in the Pacific too. And keyboard warriors who abused a young climate change advocate from Palau over his ethnicity are driven off social media by a wave of popular support. Those stories to come, but first, the only gold mine in Solomon Islands, Gold Ridge, has been dormant for the past 5 years, but now its owners have announced a multi-million dollar deal with one of China's biggest state-owned enterprises. The head of Gold Ridge Mining Limited, Walter Nazon, says China Railway International will build a mill, roads and bridges to get the mine up and running again. The deal was signed just as the Solomon Islands government were voting to switch diplomatic allegiance from Taiwan to China. But as Evan Wasuka reports, both Gold Ridge and the government deny there's any connection.
At its height, Gold Ridge's production contributed close to 30% of Solomon Islands' gross domestic product. But since 2014, the country's only gold mine has been in shutdown after its Australian owners, Santa Barbara, closed up shop following flash floods in the area. They left behind an environmental mess and sold the operation to local landowners for $100 Australian. Since then, landowners have teamed up with Australian-based Chinese company AXF and Chinese company Wango International Mining. In a major development, Gold Ridge Mining has announced that it's contracting one of China's biggest state-owned enterprises, China Railway International Group, to help develop the mine. Walter Nazon is chairman of the Gold Ridge Mining Limited. Mr. Nazon says the groundwork at the mine is expected to start early next year.
So once we sell the gold to our sea and the money comes, we pay China Rail. Gold Ridge Mining Limited will pay China Rail over the 16 years about $825 million.
Mr. Nazon says negotiations have been ongoing since February and the agreement will be in four phases.
We actually signed an agreement with them for the first $200 million to bring the mine into the production.
Dr. Godena Nau is a researcher at the University of South Pacific in Fiji. He says although Gold Ridge has been dormant for the past 5 years, it still has economic potential for Solomon Islands.
Other things that come with the reopening of the mine, like employment opportunities, revenue or income for the country, and benefits for the landowners.
The deal has raised eyebrows as it came just as Solomon Islands switched diplomatic ties from Taipei to Beijing. But the permanent secretary for the Ministry of Mines, Christopher Vehe, says the government has not been involved.
Definitely not privy to any of the commercial arrangements that were done. And so we treat the preliminary announcement as very commercial in nature.
Gold Ridge's Walter Nazon says there's nothing political about the deal.
Even though China Rail is the largest SOE companies in China, we have not connected to that one. So we actually, it's a private sector, private deal. It's a private company deal.
Gold Ridge came into production in 1996, but in that time, it's gone through nine owners. While it's had many highs, it's also had plenty of lows, from concerns of missing landowner royalties, social impact on communities, and environmental damage, including a tailings dam that came close to bursting. Dr. Nanao says all these lessons have to be taken into account for the future.
It's important that healthy communication is entertained and that everybody is fully aware of the implications of this, you know, the reopening of that mine.
The government, too, is optimistic but also cautious about the new developments at Gold Ridge.
Gold Ridge Mine is a low-grade mine. It's a very small mine, but with further discoveries, as the company is committed to doing, I hope it can bring about positive changes.
Solomon Islands Permanent Secretary for Mines, Christopher Vehe, ending that report from Evan Wasuka. Pacific carver industry insiders are waiting anxiously for the Australian government to fulfil a commitment to ease restrictions on carver imports. As Liam Fox reports, it's been 6 months since submissions closed on a proposal to increase the amount of carver people can bring into the country for personal use.
In Vanuatu, they're in the midst of what they're calling a green gold boom. Carver prices are high and farmers are making good money.
It's mind-boggling because carver is becoming the biggest commodity that's being exported out of Vanuatu in comparison to copra, cocoa, vanilla.
Joseph Bruhn's company, Bruhn's Exports, sends around a ton of dried carver to the US, Canada, Switzerland and Hungary every month. But another big potential market Australia remains closed to commercial carver imports.
Australia could be the biggest carver buyer for Vanuatu and Pacific as a whole. We're hoping that there should be something positive outcome to carver importations for Australia.
Back in January, during his historic trip to Vanuatu and Fiji, Australia's Prime Minister Scott Morrison announced his government would look at easing carver import restrictions. Soon after, the Office of Drug Control released a proposal to increase the amount people can bring into the country for personal use from 2 to 4 kilograms. It came as a disappointment to many in the carver industry who'd been hoping for a resumption of commercial imports. Many of the submissions from the Pacific to the proposal said the mooted increase was inadequate and unlikely to make much of a difference to Pacific farmers and businesses. It's now been 6 months since submissions closed, and there's been no announcement on whether the proposed increase will proceed or if it will be altered following public feedback. Joseph Brun says he and other exporters and farmers are waiting to hear the outcome.
Most of them, my friends, the exporters that I spoke to, most of them, they want to see the day that we can actually export carver to Australia. And there is a big demand. You know, everyone is praying and hoping for that to happen.
There are similar sentiments in Fiji, the region's other big carver producer.
Oh yeah, it's been 20 years. We've been waiting to see what Australia can offer to the Pacific.
Praveen Narayan owns Green Gold Carver, which exported 500 tons of the stuff last year. Like many in the Pacific, he's bemused by the sensitivities around carver in Australia, where commercial imports were banned because it was being abused in remote Indigenous communities. He noted with interest the recent decision by the Australian Capital Territory, which encompasses Canberra, to legalise cannabis use.
Carver is not been allowed to be used in Australia and cannabis is. So it's a bit of irony that this has happened and carver has been left out for a long, long time.
In a short statement to Pacific Beat, Australia's Therapeutic Goods Administration said the regulation of import limits for carver is a complex matter.
The government is giving careful consideration of the options available for carver use in Australia. It anticipates more details will be provided in the coming months with regards to any amendments to the carver travel allowance and the corresponding pilot program.
Back in January, Prime Minister Morrison's announcement that Australia would look to ease import restrictions was made in the context of his government's so-called step-up policy to strengthen relations with Pacific Islands countries. In Vanuatu, Joseph Brun says carver is such an important industry that if restrictions are not eased significantly, the step-up will be meaningless.
The decision has to be made. Otherwise, you know, you're just sort of like you're preaching something that you're not, you know, actually going to be doing. It's a rhetorical point.
Vanuatu carver exporter Joseph Brun ending Liam Fox's reports. I'm Richard Hewitt, and you're listening to Pacific Review. Echoing the words of Australia's Prime Minister Scott Morrison, the US Deputy Military Commander for the Pacific says Washington is stepping up in the region. Major General John P. Johnson has been in Palau to mark the 25th anniversary of its independence, and the visit coincided with the official launch of a new US-built coastal surveillance system, described as a world first.
We now have the radar demonstration up and running.
So this is the actual system itself. This is what the operator sees on a day-to-day basis.
As Palau moves towards closing off most of its exclusive economic zone to commercial fishing, the need for high-tech surveillance is paramount, and that's where Travis Schrammeck and his team from the University of San Diego have stepped in.
Our team has designed and constructed the coastal surveillance system and has worked on the implementation of the system here with marine law enforcement in the Republic of Palau.
The new system, positioned on 2 sites with 3 more to come, can track vessels operating illegally in the zone from up to 110 kilometers away.
The marine law enforcement operator will be able to control these camera systems as well as the radar systems, and they can operate those while looking at all the vessel movement within the EEZ of Palau.
And with the ability to track vessels over bigger distances, that makes life easier for Palau's marine law enforcement officers.
It takes almost a full day to mobilize the marine law enforcement vessels. So having both a radar to see possible vessel traffic that isn't reporting like they are supposed to, or be actually able to see them with the camera systems, allows for early identification and better utilization of the resources that marine law enforcement has at their disposal.
Meanwhile, in another part of the country, work continues on a tracking system of a different type, a missile tracking system. Also US-built, the need for the system has been reinforced in just the last 24 hours after North Korea carried out yet another missile test. And the Deputy Regional Commander for the American military, General John P. Johnson, says Washington stands ready to protect Palau.
We are committed to the defense of Palau in every respect, regardless of the threat. There is an appreciation that we have been busy elsewhere, but we're back. And we're back for all the right reasons. We're back because of the essence of the compact that we made.
And to reinforce the point, Washington has plans to deploy more troops to Palau more often, with some missions spreading over days, others over months.
We're working with our embassy to determine exactly the type of soldiers and leaders we're going to bring here for the greatest benefit. We're going to determine, is it engineering, medical, other security, probably work with your national police force, but on the ground here for 4 to 6 months.
General Johnson says the U.S. is stepping up and its presence is set to increase elsewhere in the Pacific too.
We're also going to be in other Pacific Island countries like East Timor, Papua New Guinea, Tonga, Fiji, Vanuatu and Samoa. So we're going to be throughout the Southwest Pacific as well.
And General Johnson says it's all about protecting island nations from a range of threats, one of which Washington considers to be China. But he says economic threats like illegal fishing are just as important, which is why so much American money has been invested in the new coastal surveillance system in Palau, which is unlike anything else that exists anywhere in the world at the moment. And that report was produced with assistance from Bernadette Carrion in Karoor. So, both Australia and the United States stepping up in the Pacific, and now India has pledged millions of dollars for the region in the form of loans for climate change-related projects. But while analysts see that as a sign of India ramping up its visibility in the Pacific, as Priyanka Srinivasan reports, critics are concerned India are imitating China's controversial development practices, generally labelled as debt-trap diplomacy.
Namaskar. Good afternoon.
Amid the flurry of meetings at last week's United Nations General Assembly in New York came an announcement on the sidelines from India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi. India would provide loans for climate change-related projects in the region, specifically a $150 million line of credit for Pacific nations undertaking solar or renewable energy projects. It was part of India's strengthening of ties with the region, said Prime Minister Modi.
We are happy to have organised a meeting with Pacific leaders. We are important partners in each other's developments. India has a good relationship with all Pacific nations.
This $150 million line of credit, it has never been a part of India's foreign policy strategy.
Dr. Shubhamitra Das is a specialist in India-Pacific relations.
With the Pacific Island countries, it is following the path of China. And if this is line of credit, what does that mean? The thing is to project India's power. The economic growth is becoming coming up well. India is trying to show its power in the region. It's like we can compete along with China.
Dr. Das believes questions remain over India's loans to the Pacific, details of which are yet to be made public by the government.
It's nice, actually, when a country collaborates for development. But this line of credit, how it's going to be repaid, what are the conditions?
Prime Minister Modi has also announced $12 million in funding to Pacific nations in so-called high-impact development projects of their government's choosing. It comes just 4 years after Prime Minister Modi's historical visit to Fiji for the launch of the Forum for India-Pacific Islands Cooperation, where he was given a rock star welcome.
Modi, 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 Modi.
Though Dr. Das believes China's rise in the region may explain some of India's increased interest, she believes imitation is not the government's primary motive.
China seems to be everywhere, but that doesn't mean India is talking China, you know? And likewise, if that is said, then it has to be taken with a pinch of salt, because the Pacific Island region, they form a very important part in India's Indo-Pacific policy.
And Pacific Islands may welcome the extra attention, says Razim Ali from the School of Government, Development and International Affairs at the University of the South Pacific.
We normally had the traditional partners, what we call them, the members from the OECD member countries. However, now we are seeing these members of the non-OECD countries funding development projects in the Pacific. I mean, and apart from India, China is a classic example as well. And I think this is something we call the era of choice, and it's up to the Pacific Island countries to choose.
And though she believes some countries have faced challenges with China's conditional loans, she says it's up to Pacific leaders to ensure they don't suffer the same fate with India's offer.
Speaking from past experiences, I mean, like in the case of China, one has to understand that when we are talking about concessional loans, it must be repaid. However, I mean, having said that, I think it is up to the countries to carefully consider their own repayment capacity.
And Razim Ali is optimistic that Pacific Islands can benefit from India's increased engagement.
What I see is that Pacific Island countries benefiting a lot from these capacity building projects and technical assistance from India.
Razim Ali from the University of the South Pacific, ending that report from Priyanka Srinivasan, and you're listening to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. Keyboard warriors who took to social media to condemn teenage climate change advocate Carlos Manuel from Palau because he wasn't born in the country have been shouted down by a wave of popular support. And after returning to Palau from the recent UN Climate Summit in New York, the teenager has stepped up his campaign by criticising Australia's Prime Minister for suggesting young people should be protected from the climate change debate to prevent unnecessary anxiety. An enthusiastic greeting for Carlos Manuel on his return to Palau from the UN Climate Summit in New York, but not everyone in the country, it appears, is hailing the teenage climate change advocate as a hero. And journalist Bernadette Carrion, who has followed Carlos's journey to the US and back, says that's not because of what he's done, but because he was born in the Philippines.
So there was some pushback about him being a non-Palawan. They were thinking that this is like a political government thing where Carlos was 17 years old, by the way. He's a minor. He had lived in Palau since he was 9 years old. And this is not his first time to talk about climate change. This young boy has been fighting for climate change for a long time.
The attacks on Carlos were centered on social media, and some posts teetered on the brink of plain racism, but the young climate advocate says his detractors just spurred him on.
All those bashers who talk bad things about me, it actually motivated me to do the things that I love doing. And plus, I know that people are there supporting me throughout this whole journey. And basically, those people think they're going to put me down, but basically just motivated me.
And in the end, Bernadette Carrion says the majority in Palau hit back and drove the haters off the social media pages by calling them out and creating a series of hashtags in support of the teenager who stood up for their country on the world stage.
Those who have first posted attacks against Carlos, in the end, they have put it down because almost everyone in Palau was angry, was upset about the criticism against this young man. So in the end, it all turned out to be very good. Carlos is a hero. Carlos is thanked for his work on Palau.
And even while the social media campaign against him was gathering pace, Carlos says he and his fellow young climate change advocates who gathered in New York did have an impact.
It kind of hurts, but at the same time, if I don't do it, then who will do it? And at the same time, the reason why I'm doing this is because this is the place that I call home. And the people that I built relationship with lives in this island. And it's just really sad to see that if this island disappears, I don't know where we will live.
And there was support for Carlos from Palau's president, Tommy Remengasau Jr.
It's the children's future. Doesn't matter where you're from. The world is the kids' world. And I'm quite realistic to know that our older generation will not solve everything, so that we need to leave it up to the kids, the next generation, to do it. And I think they're more passionate because it's their future.
Of course, the most notable of the young climate change warriors to travel to New York was the 15-year-old Swede Greta Thunberg, whose impassioned speech prompted a sarcastic backlash from President Donald Trump when he tweeted, "She seems like a very happy young girl looking forward to a bright and wonderful future." And Australia's Prime Minister Scott Morrison set out his view on what young people should be told about climate change, one which Carlos Manuel says is out of step with what so many young people are actually thinking.
Yeah, we've got to deal with the policy issues and we've got to take it seriously. But I don't want our children having anxieties about these issues.
That's just really sad to hear, because he's saying that we don't have to worry about it, but as far as I know, or as far that I could see, there's no change happening. And if we don't stand up for our future, then who will? Our leaders, instead of thinking of their re-election, they should be thinking about the people they're serving. And if us youths don't stand up for our rights, then we wouldn't have a better future for us and a better planet for us to live in.
That's the teenage climate change advocate from Palau, Carlos Manuel. Well, the Pacific Climate Change Centre is open for business now in Samoa with the aim of becoming the regional Pacific hub for research and discussion, blending science and indigenous knowledge. And as Jordan Fennell reports, as the conversation around climate change continues to evolve, activists believe the new centre will offer an alternative pathway for action in the Pacific Islands.
At the grand opening of the Pacific Climate Change Centre, the Prime Minister of Samoa gave a keynote speech.
In order for us as Pacific peoples to take control of our own paths in this fight, we need to build capacity and institutions through knowledge, training, networking, and research. Our expectations are that the centre can deliver on these needs. Therefore, I would encourage all Pacific countries to take advantage of the opportunities this centre will provide.
Mr. Tuila'epa Salele's call for Pacific nations to take advantage of the institution is exactly what the centre wants. The newly opened PCCC sits in Samoa's capital, Apia, but its aim is to be a hub for climate change information and research for all of the Pacific Island nations. Mr. Apito William Sio, who is New Zealand's Minister for Pacific Peoples, says it's a welcome addition to the region.
The centre is important because science is important, indigenous knowledge is important, and this centre will be the catalyst of bringing the two together to help leaders determine solutions to many of the climate change effects that they're feeling.
The centre is the first of its kind in the Pacific. Set up through funding by Japan's government at an estimated cost of $8 million and constructed in partnership with Samoan companies, the centre will have 50% of its energy needs met by solar panels and aims to run on 100% renewable energy in the future. New Zealand's Minister, Mr. Sio, whose government is also contributing staff and funding to the centre, says the PCCC will help push people into action.
There's a sense of urgency about moving forward, a sense of urgency about taking ambitious action. And this centre is going to provide informed evidence to help guide the kinds of action that the region will undertake.
But he says he doesn't expect the action to come from Pacific leaders. Instead, he says it will come from a younger generation.
I think for a long time, many of our leaders have bought into those the view of the world that you've got to maximise whatever profits from these resources, whereas now you've got coming through the ranks, young people who are well-versed in their cultures, their languages, who are now challenging the norm. And I'm saying to all of them that it's actually quite a good thing, but we need to use both modern science as well as our traditional knowledge to be able to find the right kinds of solution that can help us not only protect our current environments, protect our home bases, but to ensure that we keep it safe and safeguarded for the next generation.
Patricia Malam is a senior communications specialist with international climate change organisation 350 and says that she agrees the centre will help young climate activists.
In order for our youth activists to be effective in the work that they do, we're going to need this sort of access to information, because activism isn't just about, you know, going out there and saying things without being backed by solid knowledge systems, whether they're science-based or indigenous knowledge-based. So definitely this will help our activists immensely.
While the debate on climate change and how best to address it continues, Ms. Malam says time is running out to respond, and she hopes this centre will offer a new, exciting voice to the conversation.
In the region, you have lots of different players in this space, but people develop toolkits, people have research, they've got data, but then they all sit in different places. And I guess once we have a cohesion in where all of this begins to come together, that's something that's going to really help us. And in order to do that, we all need to have access to relevant information.
That's Patricia Malam from 350.org and the reporter there, Jordan Fennell. And that rounds out this edition of Pacific Review. I'm Richard Ewart, and as always, thank you very much for listening.